Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in and around New York City, and our show brings the culture to horticulture. So I just wanted to remind our listeners that the show is now at 1 p.m., if you're listening live, from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And we have a new format for those who are new listeners, one whole hour to devote to all things budding. And our show will also now be once monthly to sort of allow us more time to devote to research and producing the show. So Alice has some exciting news to share with everybody.
I do. We won again. We won 3 silver awards from the Garden Writers Association. And we are up for gold with these 3 silver awards. So we are crossing our fingers. Thank you, clapping hands.
Yeah, I think how many GWA awards have we won in the past 4 years?
20. We've won at least one silver for 4 years
yeah,
in a row now.
So we have, I think, at least 8 awards for talent.
Yeah. So for this year, we won Podcast Talent and Best Podcast Overall. 2 awards for our series, People and Places. We won for the episode with Grow NYC and for the other episode with Betsy Barlow Rogers. And then the super fun one is Best Talent, Best Podcast Talent for our interview with Marta McDowell for her book, All the President's Men.
From Gardens. All the President's Gardens.
All the President's Gardens. Sorry, that's a movie, right? All the President's Men.
Yes. It's about to be remade, yeah. I think, in real time. It could be all the President's Men and all the President's Women.
Yeah.
And that's really gratifying because that's a serious book.
It is.
You know? Yep. And it was a very timely book,
Betsy Barlow Rogers is very serious.
Yeah. And it's great,
and
too.
And Grow NYC, yeah. All the work that they do.
And those awards were great because the guests were live in the studio. It was really nice to feature New York people live, you know?
Right. So let's get back to today and quit talking about ourselves. We, as you know, if you've been listening, we have a theme running throughout this year's programs, and the theme is land and climate. Our country is so big, and we have so much diversity in the land and the people and the weather and the climate that we wanted to highlight that by using the USDA map as a guide. So each show will focus on one USDA zone and the people and the places that make it unique. So today we are at 6,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And on each show, we're going to talk to gardeners, farmers, extension agents, botanists, writers, and growers who reflect new, unique, and relevant ideas in each zone. We will share their stories with you each month and periodically on our blog, and maybe create a little zone envy in the process. So, for example, here in Brooklyn, we are in Zone 7B. So that means, on the average, the coldest it gets in our garden is 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Not warm enough for Carmen's lemon trees to remain outdoors, but great for lots of other plants. So this map is what the growers, gardeners, and anyone working in horticulture uses to determine what can grow where. It's a guide to your patch of earth. When you buy a plant, it often lists the hardiness zone to help you decide if you can grow it where you live or if you need to bring it indoors for the winter, which is mostly what I do.
Yeah. Or just let it die like I do. You're so burnt out by December. You're like, I could drag that begonia
in. I hate this
in.
Plant.
But I have to say, this year I've rescued a few things. A bedraggled pomegranate from one of our clients is covered in fruit. A begonia that I threw in the corner of the garage and forgot about for 6 months, I dragged it out and it came back. So it just, I love the resiliency of plants.
Yeah.
It helps me remember, you know,
why we do what we do.
Why we do what we do. Anyway, so today we're going to do zone 6. And we kind of hit, that's the halfway mark of the year and the halfway point in our season.
And the halfway point of all the zones.
Yes, exactly. So we're going to travel.
And the halfway point in the middle of the country.
Yes, exactly. We are going to go out west, a little west and a little north. So we travel to two cities in zone 6 that lie on the banks of two great bodies of water, Lake Erie and the Great Salt Lake. And that's about where their similarities end. These two cities and these two climates, even though they're both zone 6, technically couldn't be more different.
Mm-hmm.
So, but before we bring our guests on to talk about their respective growing experiences, I want to talk about zone 6 in general, which is the first zone that we're covering where temperatures dip into the negative territory
right.
in the winter. So if you look at the USDA map of the zones, zone 6 cuts this like great swath of light and dark green from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to the southeastern corner of Colorado. Much of southern New England and the northern and western suburbs of New York City fall into zone 6. Most of Ohio and the southern halves of both Indiana and Illinois are in zone 6, along with their respective capital cities, which I found really interesting. Moving west and into the Great Plains and some of our most productive agricultural regions, most of Missouri and Kansas fall into zone 6. And it kind of seemed appropriate that this zone was colored green as it covers like the heart of our nation, our like agricultural core.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my favorite zone, I think, so far.
I like the purple zones.
Yeah, the purple zones are good too. So zone 6 also touches the southwest. It touches the northern tip of Oklahoma, parts of the panhandle of Texas, as well as Santa Fe and sections of eastern New Mexico. Now, in states that fall into colder zones generally, Zone 6 follows the waters. It hugs the southern and eastern coast of three of the Great Lakes, Ontario, Erie, and Michigan, as well as the western coast of Lake Huron, which I found really interesting. Mm-hmm. That's pretty far north
yep.
to be zone 6. Most of that area is like zone 4 mm-hmm. and 5 and even 3. So the green ribbon of zone 6 follows not just lakes, but also rivers. The land along the banks of the Missouri and the Ohio rivers in the plains, as well as the Great Columbia River in the Pacific Northwest, are in zone 6. So I think
it's a big one.
It's a big zone and it's a fertile zone.
Uh-huh.
You know, very, very fertile.
Big and fertile. Mm-mm.
So it was this phenomenon of water tempering climate that inspired the theme of the show. You know, I was really interested in like bodies of water and cities being developed along them, you know, that kind of thing. So Buffalo, New York is perched on the edge of Lake Erie. And Salt Lake City, Utah, lies on the eastern edge of its namesake lake, which is the largest saltwater lake in the United States. Now, both mm-hmm. of these cities are in Zone 6, and as I said, the climates and the weather couldn't be more different. When I went across country many years ago and I cross Utah, I thought of it as like really dry and hot. And it is. And it doesn't get a lot of rain, you know?
Right.
And when I went to Buffalo this winter, it was like I couldn't imagine
it's wet
anything
and cold.
Living
right.
there, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
And it's also important to note that the Garden Writers Association conference is going to be in Buffalo. And Buffalo is called the Garden City.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not thought of...
it's not thought of for gardens in the way
it's
Charleston
of,
is.
Yeah. Or we've had
New Orleans.
Yeah. We've had people from California. And even like Philadelphia is
right.
kind of known as a, like the whole main
the
line.
The basket of horticulture,
know,
right.
The sort of the historical part of horticulture. So these places, they're very different from each other. They have surprising climates, you know, and I thought it would be interesting for folks to learn about them. And as I was talking to the guests, they also bring a lot to the equation with their experience. They have a lot of, I guess, diverse experience, you know, working in the area. And one of the guests was really fascinating to me. She does like travel, a garden travel for AAA.
Oh.
Which is really, really...
I didn't know they did that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah, they do.
And Carmen, you're getting ready to go on a big excursion odyssey.
Yes. I wonder... I'm going to plot out how many zones I cross.
Yeah.
I'll take my...
So Carmen is driving out to Yosemite.
Yes. I'm going to be flying out to Manhattan, Kansas, which is the Little Apple. They have a little water tank shaped like an apple.
Please take a picture of yourself in front of that.
I will. And I'm going to be eating a lot of, I think...
Jerky.
No, I think I'm going to be eating a lot of sausage gravy and grits and biscuits. Which I'm looking forward to. So I'm going to be putting Italian food behind me for a couple of weeks, for a short while. Maybe if I hit the Olive Garden,
you're going to get some chili. You're going to get some good chili in the West.
So then we're going to go through Kansas. We're going to go to Kansas. Then we're going to drive up to Denver, drive through Wyoming, Salt Lake City, because I have to check out Salt Lake City. I mean, when are the chances that I'm going to be going through there? And then we're going to be going to a Carson City, which is happens to be the capital of Nevada. I just recently discovered that.
Yeah.
And checking out the Mint in Carson City, because that's how we make husbands happy. and then we're going to drive from there to Mono Lake, which is also a really salty lake. And then from there to Yosemite. And I just last night bought John Muir's book on Yosemite because I kind of want to read it
as you're there.
Yeah,
of course,
you know.
Yes.
So I think that would be a good read. And I'm starting to get a little bit excited about the landscape because it's such a Yosemite is such an American
thing.
It's just so vast and there's like nothing like it in the world.
Well, it started
the
idea for the park system.
Exactly.
You know? Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And John Muir, everybody should read John Muir, you know? So it was really, really great, you know, looping back to the GWA awards to win for things that are community minded, right? Every one of those shows was about the Green Metropolis, New York City, right?
Betsy Barlow Rogers.
The second one where we got Best Talent was about the presidents and how they greened up the spaces around
the White House.
And then, you know, one of my personal favorite shows with Gerard Lodahl, somebody who has made his entire career about community gardening.
Mm-hmm.
So it just felt really, really good to...
And now you're going out like Horace Greeley. Go west, young
woman.
Yes.
So we should bring on our guest, Jeff Ellis. Jeff is a landscape architect in Salt Lake City. He was born and raised in Utah and received a master's degree in landscape architecture from Utah State University. He is the past president of the Utah Association Garden Clubs and currently the president of the Alternative Garden Club. He serves on the board of several charitable organizations and enjoys hiking, mountain biking, and cross-country skiing. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So how did you get started in gardening, and what drew you to the profession of landscape architecture?
You know, I grew up next to the mountains. It was kind of our backyard, and so that was the days before video games. So we were out playing, and we were exposed to nature. And I was always fascinated by nature and by plants and the way you can take a seed and put it in the soil, and it'll come up and grow into something that's living.
Right.
And so found out there was a profession like landscape architecture that allows you to work with living and to create environments for people. It seemed like a natural thing.
So tell us a little bit about your landscape architecture work. Do you do residential, commercial?
I have done residential and commercial work. Most recently, most of my work has been parks and recreation.
Oh, okay, good.
Designing trails and restoring natural habitats, things like that.
Awesome.
That's really exciting. I'm hoping to check out some of those when I come out there,
yeah.
Jeff and I were talking about Antelope Island. I'm hoping to have enough time to go out there. It's like a beautiful, I guess like a peninsula that juts out into the mm-hmm. lake. It has bison and stuff. It sounds really, really cool. All right. So we talked about Salt Lake City falling into Zone 6. And as I mentioned, I thought it was going to be fall into a hotter zone, more of like a southwestern thing. Tell our listeners about the climate there and the effect that the lake has on the climate seasonally.
Well, the lake has a little bit of a moderating effect, but not much. We still have a climate of extremes, cold, snowy winters, wet, cool springs, extremely hot, dry summers, and then mild, sunny autumns. There is a lake effect in the sense that for some of our winter storms, the areas downwind of the lake will get 1 or 2 extra inches of snow, which I understand in Buffalo that they get 1 or 2 extra feet, not more of snow.
Wait, so
that starts in September.
Wait, we're gonna be qualifying that in the second half of the show. But you get a lot of snow too in Salt Lake City area, right?
Pardon?
You get a lot of snow in the Salt Lake City area as well, right?
Yes, we do. The city itself normally gets about 60 inches a year.
Wow.
And some of the surrounding mountains get 500 inches a year.
500 inches.
Yeah.
That's
It's some of the best skiing in the country.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's great. And so how much rain do you get annually there?
You know, at the Salt Lake Airport, we normally get 16 inches of rain.
Wow.
And almost all of that falls during the autumn, winter, and spring. Summers are essentially rainless. We'll get an occasional thunderstorm, but the atmosphere is so dry that the water droplets almost never reach the ground, and so we almost go for 3 or 4 months without rain.
Right. You have such extremes.
Yeah, as you said. So the southwestern feeling is we're not too far off, even though technically Utah is not, Salt Lake City is not considered part of the southwest necessarily, right?
Yeah, but in many ways we do have a southwestern climate.
Mm-hmm. Right. So tell our listeners, just in case people don't know, and I'm not, this is a big topic, but just quick geography lesson about why Salt Lake City is Salt Lake City. Tell us about the lake.
Well, you want to know the history of the city or the history of the lake?
The lake.
The lake. Okay. It's a part of the Great Basin. And so there is no outlet to any ocean. All the streams that flow in, there's no way for them to get out. The only way that water is removed is through evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these streams and rivers that flow down into the bottom of the basin, they carry trace amounts of minerals and salt with them. The water evaporates, but the salt is left behind. And so over thousands of years, the Great Salt Lake has just become saltier and saltier.
Mm-hmm. So how's the soil for gardening?
We have very alkaline soil in most places in Utah. most of our gardens have a pH of 8. And if you go to the shores of the Great Salt Lake, you can find soil with a pH of 10.
Wow.
So that's a big challenge for us.
Yeah. So tell us about your plant selections.
Well, the alkalinity means that we cannot grow anything in the acid-loving family. That includes azaleas and rhododendrons and blueberries.
Mm-hmm.
I always had clients asking me about, I want to grow azaleas. I say, well, unless you put them in a pot full of peat moss, you're not going to grow them in Utah.
Right, right.
Even things like red oaks and red maples, which look so appealing at Lowe's or Home Depot.
Jeff, are you with us? Hello?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Hi, we lost you for
a
second.
We lost you. Cutting in and out a little bit.
The last thing we heard you say was about the red oaks, that they look so great at Lowe's and Home Depot, but they just don't work in your area.
That's right.
Right.
So yeah, I call them suicide trees.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because we just had a client ask us for aspens.
Right.
And we're like, no, that...
Well, I mean, aspens do grow natively in upstate New York.
Yeah.
But not on a roof terrace in New York City.
It's sort of like, I guess people get sentimental about their plants. So maybe that azalea-loving client was from the Northeast. Is that possible? Or the South?
Aspen is actually the state tree of Utah,
mm-hmm.
but it's native to the high elevation mountains. And you bring it down to the valley, and it just doesn't do so well. So
yeah.
I've had lots of clients, they say, oh, the aspen are so pretty, I want to plant aspen. I say, well, you can, but they just are not the best choice.
Right, right. And that's what we're telling our
We're elevated. I mean, we're on a rooftop, but that's not what,
well,
you know.
Yeah.
But it's not the same.
It's not the same, no.
So let's talk about elevation and like how high is Salt Lake City, you know, in terms of feet, and how does that impact, you know, what you can grow there?
Salt Lake is about 4,400 feet above sea level.
Wow.
And so that's more than most cities.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we're not like some of the cities in South America, Bogota or Cusco, Peru.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the biggest effect of the altitude is that the sun is very strong here.
Yes.
There's less atmosphere to filter the sun. And a lot of plants that in most climates would need full sun actually do better with half a day of sun in Utah. Like, I have roses planted on the east side of my house, so they're shaded all afternoon. They do beautifully, and they bloom much more than if they got full sun all day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I actually did a garden once up in the mountains in Breckenridge, Colorado. We were at 14,000 feet. And it was very interesting talking to the growers there as we were purchasing the plants. And I was learning, just as you described, because I was thinking roses, roses, roses.
Yeah.
And they said, like, I was thinking of the rugosas, and they said they do work, but you've got to give them some shade. It's not like at sea level where they can take 8-10 full sun hours. You know, it's just the climate is so harsh.
And on the plus side, I remember when we were talking, Jeff, you said that the roses in Utah almost never get diseases because of there is no humidity at the time that they're in full bloom and growing well. So you all don't have to spray like we do, because we get constant frequent rain during the growing season. So that's a good.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's kind of good.
Yeah, I've never seen black spots on roses, and my floribunda roses, I've never had to spray them.
Yeah, boy, we've got some work out here for you if you'd like to spray.
So let's talk a little bit about the drought that just ended. Right, this year was the first year that it finally got a decent snowpack. Right,
you've
had a 5-year drought in Utah. right? Even though you all have plenty of water coming down from the snowpack, for a few years there, it was minimal. So how has that impacted in your practice and generally, do you think, the design and planting of gardens?
Well, you know, we're really relieved and pleased to have had a normal or actually above normal snow year and have plenty of water this year. But in the long term, drought is still a concern.
Yeah.
And water-wise gardening, water conservation are a big topic, a big trend up here.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more about some of the plants that you love to use.
Well, we've talked about roses. Another plant that does really well here is bearded iris. Mm. You know, they're basically a type of grass, mm-hmm. and so they can go semi-dormant in the summer and survive our heat, mm. and they just bloom like crazy in the spring. I was going to mention kind of a surprising plant that you might not think of in the desert is hostas.
Really?
But if you plant them in the correct location, which is full shade, and you just water them once a week, they do fine. They're actually pretty drought tolerant if they're in total shade.
Wow.
There's kind of a new plant that I've been trying and a few other people have been trying, which is the oak leaf hydrangea.
Mm, right.
Again, you wouldn't think of hydrangeas in the desert.
No, no.
But this one, if you put it in partial shade, like under some tall trees, water it deeply once a week, it just blooms and thrives.
Yeah, we use that a lot here. It does very well, and we use it primarily for its foliage in the fall. Is really beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and has great architecture and texture. How do penstemons do there? Do they do okay there in Utah?
Penstemons do very well. In fact, I've read that there are more penstemons native to Utah than any other state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I remember them in New Mexico, too.
Yeah, yeah.
They were very prolific in New Mexico, in the mountains.
We went picking once along, like, some highway.
Yeah, in Santa Fe and up by Taos. I remember them. Yeah.
And what about grasses? I think of them. I mean, they work really well here in New York, but how do they do at the higher elevations? Are there ones that work?
Yes, there are. The Japanese maiden grass grows quite well. There's the Penicetum. I've used one called Hamlin, which
doesn't get quite
as big.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually will reseed itself.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one planting where we started out with three of them, and I revisited it, and there's about a dozen of them growing now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the grasses do quite well.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And what about evergreens? Let's talk about evergreens. Do you guys use a lot of junipers, I would imagine?
Yes. Junipers are a really tough plant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a native Utah juniper, which is quite common. Ironically, the Virginia juniper is actually easier to grow just because it's easier to propagate,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As well as the Chinese juniper, all the cultivars of those. And in the 1970s, the Pfizer junipers were really popular. They were the landscape solution. You plant them and
you'll never do anything again. Yeah.
And now they're sort of getting overgrown, and everybody hates them, and everybody's ripping them out. You know, there's fashions in plant as well as in clothes.
Talk about the Home Depot special, right?
Yeah. So I want to talk about your garden club. When we were looking for a group to kind of have on the show to talk about gardening in Salt Lake City, I found a few garden clubs, but yours stood out. And I'd like you to tell our listeners about the impetus for the formation of the Alternative Garden Club, a little bit about its membership, and some of its programs and activities in the region.
Well, it started in the early 1980s when most garden clubs consisted of wealthy housewives of a certain social milieu.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There was a local nursery send one of the kids. But he was expelled, and they found out that he was gay and he had a boyfriend.
Wow. Wow.
So,
wow.
So they, their own club, which would be welcoming to the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
And today, anyone is welcome to join the club. We have monthly meetings on a variety of topics ranging from rose pruning to tree planting to edible weeds to decorating for Christmas.
I find that so interesting. I'm shocked. I know.
I'm shocked that gardening gets political like that.
It's interesting. Well, I was impressed to hear that it's like the club is mostly men. Is that right, Jeff?
It is, yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah.
You know, because it is, for so long, these garden clubs were dominated by older blue-haired ladies that could meet at 11 o'clock in the morning. And frankly, very few people today have the time to do that, right?
Right.
So
That's right. I mean,
I love that you guys meet in the evenings, right? When people can...
can relax and think and
have time.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, you also do some community, you're involved in some community programs as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm involved in a mission that promotes, builds non-motorized trails for public use.
Uh-huh.
Great.
I'm involved in a couple of scholarship funds for students in landscape architecture and horticulture. As well as a charitable foundation that supports the arts and all kinds of things. So I've been kind of busy over the past couple of years.
That's great.
That's awesome.
I was so excited to, because the Garden Clubs of America list all the various clubs. That's kind of how you find people. And then I was like, Alternative Garden Club. Like, this was like, I have to talk to these people, you know?
Yeah.
I was really pushy with Jeff. I was like, Jeff, you have to respond to my email. I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Carmen and I met at the Horticultural Society of New York. Which is really the very first garden club.
Talk about blue-haired ladies and helmet heads. This is
the Astors and the Rockefellers
Whitneys.
And the Whitneys. And it was actually the men that started it.
Yes.
When culture allowed you the time to think about flowers
and botany, so it's
become such a lost art. And I think any opportunity to meet your fellow community members and talk about horticulture, and I love that you're doing these trails and making these areas accessible. You know, it just...
some more people.
It's just exactly what America is about. And
sharing. I mean, gardeners are generally generous people. They will share plants. They will share information.
And they want to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
You know?
So
hence the cultivation, right?
So I want to talk a little bit about Utah. And maybe you can give us a little insider information for myself and others listening. I loved Utah, and I went through the southern part. You know, it was like this magical moonscape of like just rocks and canyons and mesas, and I was just amazed. You know, hundreds of miles where there were no other humans. That just was so appealing.
You mean the people stacked on top of each other here in the New York City
canyons?
You have
no idea, Jeff.
Isn't enough for you?
No, the canyons of New York no longer have any appeal to me. I want to see the other canyons. So
watch out for the flash floods.
I know. Well, too bad my cheap husband, who I'm going to call out right now, wouldn't spring for a 4x4. All right. We'll see how far we actually get. But anyway, can you share a little bit with our listeners some of the like best gardening places or, you know, designy places that you think people, if they come to Salt Lake City or the surrounding area, should visit?
Well, the first place that comes to mind is Temple Square in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's famous as the world headquarters of the Mormon Church.
Right.
But it's also home to about 20 acres of just amazing gardens.
Cool.
They have a full-time crew of 25 people plus 500 volunteers.
Wow.
Who, they keep the grounds filled with flowers in spring, summer, and fall.
Wow.
Okay.
And then they do Christmas lights in the winter.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So it would be a must-see for anyone who's interested in gardens.
Okay.
We also have Red Butte Gardens, which is on a hill overlooking the city, and their plantings range from water conserving species to a children's garden, a rose garden, oak woodlands. It's really beautiful.
Cool.
I'm going to have to drag my husband to that.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be visiting U.S. Mints, he's going to be looking at some mints, too.
He's going to go to some garden.
And some salvias.
He's going to be picking it.
Exactly. Is there any other place, Jeff, that you think people should definitely see?
It was such a bad joke.
I know.
What else?
A quirky place near downtown, a sculpture garden called Gilgal Gardens.
Okay.
It comes from the Bible. It means the circle of stones.
Mm-hmm.
And it was created by a local Mormon bishop who is also a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to create a place of tranquility and inspiration. And so he did all these stone carvings and placed them around this garden of about 5 acres. It's quite an amazing example of folk art.
Hmm. That totally sounds like something that I would love to see. And then, of course, I think, is it in Salt Lake City, in the Salt Lake, that the Spiral Jetty is? Or is that California? Maybe I've got it mixed up. Maybe it's Mono Lake.
No, the Spiral Jetty is on the Great Salt Lake.
Right, right.
And, you know, if you're interested in Earth artwork, and if you want to see the really remote Utah desert, go out to the Spiral Jetty. It's not near Salt Lake. It's out in the middle of just absolute nowhere.
Okay. But it sounds
20 miles from the nearest paved road, 30 miles from the nearest house.
Wow.
But,
wow.
Yeah, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
I think you got to take your clothes off and run out there.
I know.
Right?
Well, I want to try to float on the lake.
Awesome.
It sounds
awesome. Yeah.
Because the lake is probably a lot saltier than the ocean, right? I don't know what the percentage more it is, but it's supposed to be a lot more, and you can easily float, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to definitely try to do that, maybe, if I have time. Well, Jeff, would you like to share how people can get in touch with your garden club if they're in the area, if they want to attend an event?
If they want to start one themselves.
Yeah, get some advice. How can they reach you?
They are welcome to send an email to alt@gmail.com.
Wait, it's cutting in and out. Can you say that again, Jeff?
It's Alt Garden Club, AltGardenClub, @gmail.com.
Okay.
Okay. And you have a Facebook page, too, right?
Pardon?
You have a Facebook page, too, right?
We also have a Facebook page. Just look up Alternative Garden Club, Utah, and you'll find it.
Great. Good. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show. It was really great to talk with you. And
I really feel like I just took a little mini trip there,
yeah,
Jeff. Thank you.
It was great. Thank you so much. And I may be messaging you privately on my way to Salt Lake City.
Please do.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us,
thank
Jeff.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to visit a city on another lake that's a little bit less salty. Stay tuned.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years, and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife Charlie started Bob's Red Mill almost 4 decades ago. Today they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his four children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We just left Utah. We had a little like spa vacation, Alice and I,
yes,
in Salt Lake City.
If only, right.
And now we're going to come a little bit closer to home, to Buffalo, New York.
We're going to shuffle off to Buffalo.
You know, I have to say, whenever I think of the Great Lakes, I think of that song, and I forget who the singer is, but it's called The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like a folk song.
Right. My cousins live on Lake Michigan, and they talk about it all the time.
I love that song. It's like the cheesiest folk song ever, but whenever I hear it, I get all like goosebumpy and stupid. Anyway, it's just great. If you guys want to Google it, it's actually a great song.
Yeah,
the lyrics are great. But anyway, Buffalo is on Lake Erie. And our guest today has a big connection to Buffalo. Sally Cunningham is a garden writer, educator, and certified nursery and landscape professional, well-known in Buffalo for over 23 years on Channel 4 and as a columnist for the Buffalo News and Buffalo Spree magazine. She is formerly a master gardener and cooperative extension agent. Bless her heart. I love cooperative extension agents. They do so much work.
They're the like best garden librarians in the
world. so underappreciated.
Yeah.
She's also the author of Great Garden Companions by Rodale Books, which has sold over 50,000 copies. She leads Great Garden Tours for AAA around the U.S. and Europe. And Sally was recently honored by Plant WNY, which as Person of the Year. She's also the chair as Buffalo hosts the National Garden Writers Association Conference this coming August. So, Sally, welcome to the show.
Well, hello. I'm glad to meet you.
Hi, Sally.
So, you've worn a lot of hats, and you have a lot of diverse experience in the field of horticulture. Tell us how you came to the profession. This is a question that we ask everybody who's on our show.
Oh, sure. Well, I am a woman like many who reinvented herself somewhere halfway through life, having lots of career background in New York City and government and so forth. Hmm. But coming back to finding country space near Buffalo, south of the city, I decided that organic gardening was a quality of life choice that I had to make. And in discovering it, I really learned how much there was to learn and how much information was not out there. So at some point, I re-educated myself and became a so-called expert in the field of organic gardening and beneficial insects in particular.
Hmm. Wow. So you really did leave the city for the country, like Zsa Zsa Gabor.
I really did.
Right.
I came from this area, and I had 14 years in New York, and I love New York.
Yeah.
And whenever I can, I'm back there leading garden tours to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Uh-huh.
There's so much going on there. I love your city.
Goodbye, Park Avenue, right?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons that we chose to feature Buffalo for our Zone 6 show is that most of us have the perception that it has snow from like December to June, and it doesn't seem like a city that would be famous for gardening, but it's called the Garden City, right? That's like So tell
us. Gardening has been an image changer for Buffalo. There is no doubt an image changer. When you ask any audience, and I do speaking, what's the first word that comes to mind when I say Buffalo? Of course, they say snow, or some say chicken wings or the Buffalo Bills.
Right.
None of which images is what I would like to hang my hat on.
Mm-hmm.
But some years ago, a little group of people in the center of the city said, oh, let's have a little tour of each other's gardens. And 23 years ago, it started with 18 gardens. And now there are 400 private gardens that open to the public on one two-day weekend at the end of July. And it brings in 70,000 people who come just to see gardens. And they go away blogging and tweeting and photographing and with a whole new concept of this city. And it's gone beyond out into the suburbs where now there's walks and tours. So it's 5 weeks of like a great big garden festival. Wow. And pretty amazing to the extent that it sort of won the attention of the garden writers nationally. And we're having a national convention here. So it's really been an image changer and an improver of the quality of life in Buffalo.
And I know another example of what Alice and I were talking about earlier about how
community
gardeners impact the community, how they can really change their communities right. in so many different ways. So tell us really Absolutely. What it's like. What is the weather really like in Buffalo? Because there are misconceptions about how much snow you get and how cold it is, etc.
Sure. And there's plenty of situations where we can get feet of snow, and it could be 2 feet or 3 feet, depending on where you are in Western New York. That's what we call the region, mm-hmm. Western New York State. And there's sort of a line of demarcation halfway down Buffalo that south of there you can have feet of snow, and north of there they can have 3 inches, and they think they're having a hard time. So it's yes, there is volume of snow, but it is not as deep as snow in New York State. Syracuse has that honor. They get far more than Buffalo does. And honestly, snow isn't the problem that people think it is. We do stay carefully aware of the frost dates, the first frost date and the last frost date. Mm-hmm. But it's a relatively short growing season. We don't put tomatoes in until June 1st.
Yeah, right.
But nevertheless, it's a very successful four seasons, and it's quite healthy and nice for most perennials and flowering shrubs and trees. We have our limits. I know you're talking about zone.
Yes.
But we have a wonderful range for growing.
So let's talk about the lake and its effect on the weather. Our previous guest talked about the Great Salt Lake and its tempering effect on that southwestern heat. And dryness. How does Lake Erie affect the weather in Buffalo?
I think it's the same concept in that a body of water slows down, the temperature changes affecting the area around it. Mm-hmm. And we have what we call lake effect snow, yes. which means that because the lake didn't get cold as soon as the air did, the moisture accumulation causes this white stuff called snow, and all of a sudden you can have a volume of fluffy stuff that is quite beautiful, but that's when you can have real big snowstorms, lake effect storms, lake effect snow. On the other end of the spectrum, it also means that we don't get hot so quickly. And into June and July, we have wonderful breezes off Lake Erie. So it's a comfortable climate in the summer months, not nearly as humid as, say, New York, because there are breezes, and it stays in the mid-70s very typically.
Wow.
But the lake does have its effect.
That is
and
very...
along the lake to the northern side toward Lake Ontario, there's also areas where you can grow peaches north of here. That it would be a mild zone 6 or even a zone 7 kind of plant. So the lake has everything to do with our weather pattern. And most of us are pretty grateful to have it, even including the fact that our waterfront has now become a huge tourism scene, and we're doing like many cities and making the most of an outstanding waterfront.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Buffalo is all about the water.
Right. Well, it used to be about the industry.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
So I think now they're realizing that that's a lot of great real estate, you know, to be improved upon.
We saw that firsthand in Pittsburgh at the last Garden Writers Association event, that conference that we went to. We were really impressed with how Pittsburgh had revitalized its waterfront for its people.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Buffalo, the city, and its neighborhoods. When I was looking and reviewing the you know, all the tours that the Garden Writers Association is putting on in mm-hmm. Buffalo, there were all these like distinct sort of neighborhoods that had different kinds of garden.
So New York.
Yeah, New York State. So tell us a little bit about the neighborhoods and the different areas and how gardening differs in those areas.
Yes, I think it's a good story. Well, first of all, part of Buffalo is the story of architecture.
Yes.
And there's wonderful, like some of what...
Sally?
Sally?
Hi, Sally.
We lost you for a second.
You're kind of cutting in and out. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I'll move.
Okay.
I think my Bluetooth turned off. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I'll move to where you can definitely get me. Is that better?
Yes, that would
That's
be great.
Good.
So say again about the we heard you about the architecture. Buffalo is about architecture.
So much of Buffalo's story is the story of the old Rust Belt city, the wonderful seaport that it was and its evolution. And that means there's all kinds of wonderful wood frame houses of 150 years old, high quality of construction. We have a great big Frank Lloyd Wright heritage, too. So in Buffalo, you have such things as the cottage district, where working class women had tiny little cottages that were just charming and cute, and they're one-person-sized houses. Hmm. And that street, if you look up Buffalo Art of Gardening, that's a odd site.
Sally? Hello?
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
we're losing you again. I don't know what's happening.
Oh, I do. I'm so sorry. I'm in the country, and sometimes we cut in and out. I'm afraid to say.
Okay.
So
you were saying about the cottage district, small houses with little gardens.
Oh, yes. The cottage district is probably our most famous of the Garden Walk Buffalo district, mm-hmm. and it's just tiny, packed. And you can see some of these backyards in 12 minutes. So it's a you walk in and out of one after the other, and I hope some of the listeners do come to Buffalo for the last 2-day weekend in July. In this case, it's an experience, but it's unforgettable and it's so different from other cities. And that's the place from the
Sally, we're having. Hi, Sally.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. It's strange. They're cut out again a little bit. I guess part of living in the country is not having the best
cell. Well, it may be. I'm going to try to. I'm literally moving out to the garden and see if that helps. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's
to do
okay.
This to you. But
okay.
Hey, I'm a gardener and I'm a garden writer and I work in the garden.
Exactly.
See if this is any better.
That sounds better. So I want to talk a little bit. So you talked about the cottage district, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the tours that the Garden Writers Association are going to give. What are the different neighborhoods that they're going to visit?
Yeah. Well, one of the tours is to the Frank Lloyd Wright House, the Darwin Martin House, and Olmsted Parks, because we have a great Frederick Law Olmsted heritage, an entire park system. So some of it's the historical places, but some of it's the middle of Buffalo, the best of Garden Walk Buffalo. They're going to get a very intensive tour. And some of it's to country homes. We have the international hosta experts, Mike and Kathy Shadrach, in Buffalo with an unbelievable garden. It's this hillside packed with daylilies and hostas.
Wow.
And the difference between some of our gardens and other tours that garden writers have done or people across the country might have done is none of these are done by professionals. These are real gardeners who sweat and dig in the soil and have dirty fingernails most of the year. And that's just a difference in the intense, personal, intimate, funky, artsy. It's a different kind of garden they're going to see here, whether in the city or in our country version.
That sounds great. And that's going to be August 5th through the 9th. Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's basically 4 to 7 for the bulk of the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's for garden writers, you don't have to be a novelist or a garden book published person to attend. If you educate people about gardening, if you're a garden speaker, blogger, Twitterer, photographer, it might be for you. And if you personally, any of you, come to Buffalo, you need to contact me.
I will, Sally.
I'm hosting this darn thing, but by the conference, I'll want to meet the people I've been talking to.
Yeah. Alice and I are definitely trying to make it work out with our schedules.
We're trying to figure out our plan to come up.
Well, I want to give you some time to talk about your work, Sally, specifically. Besides your garden writing and leading tours, I want to talk about your travel, in the U.S. and internationally. Tell us about what you do.
Well, it happened that AAA, that knows how to do trips, approached me and said, you know, we've discovered that garden tourism is huge. And actually, garden tourism is huge. And like you were talking about, so impactful for cities, you know, changing their image and bringing the quality of neighborhoods up. So AAA approached me and said, how would you like to develop great garden travel? And sounded fun to me, so I have learned it. Work as well as fun, but I love taking people to Europe or the gardens around London. I have a trip coming in August to gardens in Ireland, like private gardens of Dublin, and I'm calling it castles, gardens, and pubs. And the pubs are so some of the husbands will come along that don't often go on these garden tours.
Right.
They don't know how much fun they are. but it's just wonderful. And I'm doing one-day trips around the Buffalo region. But I love to take people to Philadelphia, the Brandywine Valley. And in early September, I'm hoping to bring a group to Chihuly, is at the Botanical Garden in the Bronx.
Yeah.
You know that.
NYBG.
And the Brooklyn Botanic Garden and the High Line above all. I love walking the High Line with people.
Yeah.
Well, if you come to New York, you have to get in touch with us, and maybe we can meet up and have a drink at a pub or a cup of coffee.
Or a tequila bar that we just opened.
Yeah, I will send you where we'll be and when.
Yeah, we just did a garden for a tequila. It's called Park Life in Gowanus, Brooklyn, and it's all about tacos and tequila.
Yeah, we did some planting for them. It's really
I like that.
Yeah,
once lived in Borum Hill.
So
you did.
Know the that's your neighborhood.
That's very cool.
Right.
Well, how can people get in touch with you, Sally, if they want to find out about your tours or your speaking engagements?
Sure. Well, if people go to AAA, AAA. Horizon Club Tours, Sally Cunningham. I know you could track me that way.
Okay.
Sally Cunningham, Great Garden Travel. Any of those combinations will lead them to me. Or go to the Visit Buffalo Niagara website, the garden tourism website in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Visit Buffalo Niagara. I can be found through there. And it tells all about these great, interesting tours of Western New York. So I hope people do come and never mind that old story about Buffalo and the snow and the dying Rust Belt city. This is really a cool place to live. It's so up and coming and so dynamic and also very comfortable in the summer.
That's good to know. It sounds very appealing. Sally, thank you so much for being on the show. And if we come out to Buffalo, we will get in touch with you. Absolutely.
It was so fun to talk to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
Thanks for all your work.
Okay. All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
So thanks for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. If you have a story to share from your zone, we're looking for gardeners from zone 5 to 1. That's you people freezing your butts off in the winter. But we want to hear your stories, too.
That's why we started.
with the hot.
In Hawaii.
Yeah. So get in touch with us, and we'll consider it for an episode or for our blog. The show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to subscribe to our blog, www.wedigplantspodcast.com. Or on Twitter at We Dig Plants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. You can also follow us on Instagram at We Dig Plants /GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks
for
listening.
Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.